Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
All right, I want to begin this evening with a myth composed by Plato. Admittedly, it's a long quote, but I suspect you'll see its relevance very quickly. This is called the myth of Thoth, also the myth of Thuth, but I had to figure out which way I found easier to pronounce, so I'm going to stick with the myth of Thoth. So Plato writes this: among the ancient gods of Naucratis in Egypt, there was one to whom the bird called Ibis is sacred. The name of the divinity was Thoth, and it was he who first discovered number and calculation, geometry and astronomy, as well as the game of checkers and dice, and above all else, writing. Now, the king of all Egypt at that time was Thamus. Thoth came to exhibit his arts to him and urged him to disseminate them to all the Egyptians. Thamus asked him about the usefulness of each art, while Thoth was explaining it. Thamus praised him for whatever he thought was right in his explanations and criticized him for whatever he thought was wrong. The story goes that Thamus said much to Thoth, both for and against each art, which it would take too long to repeat. But when they came to writing, Thoth said, "O king, here is something that once learned will make the Egyptians wiser and will improve their memory. I have discovered a potion for memory and for wisdom." Thamus, however, replied, "O most expert Thoth, one man can give birth to the elements of an art, but only another can judge how they can benefit or harm those who will use them. And now, since you are the father of writing, your affection for it has made you describe its effects as the opposite of what they really are. In fact, it will introduce forgetfulness into the souls of those who learn it. They will not practice using their memory, because they will put their trust in writing, which is external and depends on signs that belong to others, instead of trying to remember from the inside completely on their own. You have not discovered a potion for remembering, but for reminding. You provide your students with the appearance of wisdom, not with its reality. Your invention will enable them to hear many things without being properly taught, and they will imagine that they have come to know much, while for the most part they will know nothing. And they will be difficult to get along with, since they will merely appear to be wise instead of really being so." End quote. So that myth is from Plato's Phaedrus. And as with most of Plato's myths, this one is packed full of delightful imagery, but also insightful considerations. There are a lot of similarities that we can draw between Thoth and the creators of AI today. The claims that AI models will solve problems related to our mental limitations are being made left and right by their creators. There are also insightful criticisms offered by Thamus. The idea that writing will do just the opposite of what Thoth promises is key here. Thamus rightly points out that writing will not help with memory, but with recollection, which is an important distinction. Memory is like having the information in our minds, and recollection is the ability to find that information and pick it out. We can see the difference between memory and recollection easily when you consider the phenomenon of having information on the tip of your tongue, as the saying goes. It's like when somebody asks you a question to which you know the answer, like the name of a classmate, but all of a sudden you can't bring the name to mind, but it just seems to be hiding out of reach or on the tip of your tongue. In those cases, we have the memory, but the inability to recollect what we remember. And so Thamus rightly points out that writing will be a better help with recollection rather than memory, because it helps us to bring before our eyes the things that we already know. But Thamus is also right to criticize writing, because if we don't actually put the information in our heads, we will never actually know it. And so instead of memorizing information, we will just keep it in a book and so that we can look it up. But if we have to look it up every time, of course, this slows us down and it's not actually there in our head. And actually, we see this criticism is actually backed up by social studies of people's who learn how to write. In societies without writing, it's very common that people have a tremendous capacity for memory, memorizing entire books and passing them on almost word for word from one generation to the next. But once you introduce writing into a culture like that, the capacity for memory disappears or diminishes very quickly, indeed within a generation. So all of this is a perceptive criticism of the promises of writing. And yet, there is an unmistakable contradiction at the heart of this myth. It is that the myth itself comes to us in writing. So what's going on here? Is Plato a hypocrite? No. This material contradiction is very typical of Plato, and I think a beautiful imitation of his portrayal of Socrates. It is not mere hypocrisy. It is, in fact, what Plato calls a tool of dialectic, where we who read and agree with the sentiments must also confront our own use of the very technology we are criticizing as we read it, and come to reflect on the dangers as well as the benefits in such a way that we can avoid the dangers while identifying and embracing the proper benefits. So this can be generalized to all technology insofar as we can recognize the potential problems while also discerning the real advantages. The dialectic between these two polarities help us to consider then new questions with respect to writing in particular. In what way does writing diminish our capacity for memory, since we do not have to stretch those muscles as much when we can write things down? And secondly, is it bad for us to have an underdeveloped memory capacity? So given the material contradiction in Plato's myth, the answer is, there is a way in which the lack of memory is bad, but there is a way in which using writing and diminishing our capacity for memory is not necessarily bad. As we see in Aristotle, all virtuous activity needs to find a particular mean between excess and defect. So in this case, we need to find a mean or a middle point between maximizing our capacity for memory and totally being devoid of memory altogether. How do we determine what the appropriate middle point is? I want to reflect on this question about the old technology of writing, and then see how that might help us to generalize and consider the new technology of AI-assisted writing models. So now, to get at an appropriate middle position, I first want to deny a very prevalent thesis in contemporary ethics, namely Hume's, quote, naturalistic fallacy, or the is-ought distinction. In his treatise on human nature, Hume famously argues that reasoning about categorical propositions related to objects in the world does not validly conclude to moral propositions about those same objects. Hume complains that there is a subtle shift in this reasoning, where people change from making statements or propositions like Sam is a human being, Sam is an American, to propositions like Sam ought not to kill, or Sam ought not to steal. Hume's objection is that the usual is between Sam and being a human subtly shifts to an ought, saying that Sam ought not to do something. And such a move, in Hume's eyes, is invalid. And there are many philosophers today who take Hume's argument as definitive. And in fact, one prominent philosopher has told me that this lesson and Hume's general theory of implication is about the only thing he is sure of, which frankly made me sad. And then he tried to get me to toast to Hume, and I had a very hard time doing that. However, I think that any Thomist or Aristotelian or even Platonist must and even should reject this thesis of Hume. This is because Hume's criticism is only sound if you accept Hume's presuppositions about the nature of categorical propositions, which is very different from the realist notion of a categorical proposition. So this is probably the heaviest philosophical part. I apologize about that at the moment. To give a definitive refutation of Hume would require more time than we have this evening, but I do want to point out some significant features of Aristotle and St. Thomas that's different from Hume. In the history of philosophy, certain novelties in logic and metaphysics among people referred to as nominalists led to a widespread skepticism about the reality of nature. In addition to the denial of nature and universal forms, nominalism eroded the central Aristotelian thesis about how being or existence comes in two forms. We can be actually, or we can be potentially. And so as a result of this denial of being actually and being potentially, nominalists like Hume have an argument to try to get rid of nature and natural obligations. But the reason why a Thomist or an Aristotelian can reject Hume's is-ought distinction is because we have a very natural explanation for how understanding what something is actually and potentially can tell us what it ought to do in a given situation. Why is this? Well, when we think about the way that something is actually and is potentially, to be actually just is simply what you are. To be potentially is what you can be. So potential being are all the ways in which you can change. Actual being are the ways that you are now. And the ways that you can actually change are not just mere possibilities, but real features of you at the moment that permit you to undergo an immediate change in certain circumstances. And all of these potencies are directed towards particular ways, particular types of changes, particular ways of being actual. Now, not all potencies are created equal, but some of these potentialities, some of these ways of changing are associated with our essence or our nature. And we see this very in a number of different ways. We see this, for instance, in just the natural growth process of human beings, right? We recognize that there are certain common growth processes. And what we recognize is that it's leading to from childhood up to something that we call adulthood. And in adulthood, we usually should have developed a certain amount of actuality or way of being presently that is typical and that is helpful for the flourishing of an individual human being. And so those potencies for growth to adulthood are directed in that way. And so likewise, then, we recognize that there are other sorts of natural potencies to change that are directed not only towards our growing towards adulthood, but towards our ultimate satisfaction and our completeness as human beings. Now, there are many ways in which we can talk about this, but the one I want to focus on this evening is a very important potency that is rooted in all human beings. And this is what Aristotle says. He says, all human beings by nature desire to know. So we all have a potency to want to know. Not just to know how, but to actually have content, have information within our minds. And we see this in a variety of ways, right? Oftentimes when I say that, people think, are you saying that everybody wants to be a highfalutin academic? No. But we do recognize that there is a desire within all of us to know certain things. We see this in children who are curious about everything. We see this in scientists and academics who love to delve into nerdy things. We even see this in the impulse to doom scroll on social media, because the fear of missing out is related to the fear of not knowing what other people are doing. We want to know because we are made to be knowers. Now, often in our society, we tend to think that value comes from doing stuff. But that is a very modern concept, one with implications that are at best dubious. And I say they're at best dubious because the impulse to do something is always ordered towards some end state where we can come to a rest. And usually when we are resting, we are trying to know or pull in the information as we rest. So you can see this in very simple things, like an award ceremony at the end of an athletic achievement, or an award ceremony at the end of your college career, right? Or even that desire to want to go home and veg in front of a movie is in fact rooted in the desire to know, because we want to rest and take in that information and find that ability to just enjoy what we have. So the potency or ability to know is fundamental to our nature, and therefore it is fundamental to our flourishing. Because because of this, we recognize that we must develop this potency to know in order to become more full in our humanity, because we desire it. And Aristotle says, once we achieve all that we desire, we will come to rest. In fact, Aristotle, oddly enough, most people don't recognize this. In book 10 of the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle tells us that the goal of all human beings is to contemplate God. Of course, he means something differently than what Christians and modern theists tend to think of as God. But nevertheless, it is interesting that Aristotle identifies the desire to contemplate as that which will bring everything to rest. Whether we agree with that or not, it is nevertheless interesting that knowledge and coming to understand really is important and really is a driving force in our lives. And it is precisely because of this that Plato was worried about writing. Why is this? Because for Plato, knowledge, for those of you who've taken ancient philosophy courses, knowledge just is recollection, the remembering of the forms. And so when Thamus says that that writing is a tool for recollection and is not a cure for memory loss, in Platonic terms, he is saying that books may help with learning, but unless you can actually grab onto the things you need to remember the forms, the books will never help. For Plato, the books have to be a source of reminding you where of the things that you already know. Now, for Thomists and for Aristotelians, we don't have the same sort of recollection theory of knowledge. But we do think that there is a difference between getting information into our heads that we know and then sifting through it to find the information that we already know. And the key here is to make sure that the information gets into our head and doesn't just stay out there. Because if the information doesn't get into our head, we will never get satisfaction. All right, so with that in mind, we might say, what are the intellectual abilities that are at risk of being diminished when we use AI-assisted writing? So we talked about writing a little bit and the dangers there. And that we've obviously, through time, been able to develop our ability to use writing to make sure the information gets into our head. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. But now I'm going to turn to AI-assisted writing. So I think there are two things that we need to be aware of when it comes to the use of AI in general, but specifically AI assistance in writing itself. And this is the first thing we have to be aware of, are what are the implications for developing our own ability to write and to communicate? It seems that if we become dependent upon AI assistance, this might diminish those capacities. Secondly, we need to think about what are the implications on our ability to know and to understand. So those are two things we're going to look at. So first, let's think about writing. So now the concern here is that developing dependency on AI-assisted writing may lead to the loss of the ability to write altogether. But we should ask, in what ways would that happen, and would it be negative to human flourishing? Now, I asked Microsoft Copilot to give me an answer to this question, and here is what it had to say. Yes, AI-assisted writing can pose some challenges for the ability to write. One of the main issues is the potential for dependency. If writers rely too heavily on AI tools, they may not develop or maintain their own writing skills, leading to a decline in creativity and originality. Additionally, AI-generated content can sometimes lack the nuanced understanding and emotional depth that human writers bring to their work. This can result in writing that feels less authentic or engaging. Furthermore, there's the risk of homogenization, where diverse writing styles and voices might be overshadowed by the more uniform output of AI systems. Balancing the use of AI with personal effort, creativity, is essential to mitigate these problems, end quote. Not a bad description. But what we're getting here in this are the general worries that people put out there on the internet that's then, of course, being fed into AI. And this answer is not crazy. But I would say that oftentimes people are worried about things like creativity when it comes to writing. But I think that actually there's a different problem when it comes to this. And this is more related to the second feature of what Copilot gave to us. I think the problem with AI-assisted writing is it has the capacity to to lead us to lose the ability to write in the first place. How so? Well, think about how we come to learn a foreign language. In learning a foreign language, we generally talk about active and passive knowledge of those languages. In active knowledge, a person is able to read, understand, and express him or herself in the target language. If one is fluent, one can do that easily and with joy. But there are also various levels of passive knowledge. One could passively know a language insofar as one can understand what other people say, but can't express oneself effectively in the target language. Also, one may not be able to even hear and understand what people are saying, but simply read what is written on the page. These are different ways in which we have passive knowledge. I think the biggest problem with AI-assisted writing is that for those who don't learn how to write first, it is possible that we become so dependent on AI assistance, we only ever have passive knowledge of writing. And that is, one may be able to understand what is written without being able to express oneself in writing. So here I'm envisioning someone who can pose a question to an AI model, and then writing will consist in simply recognizing those things that one wants to say. There is some knowledge of writing here, but it's very limited. And so this is not a worst case scenario by a long shot, but I do think it's a very, very believable scenario, and one that could happen within a generation. In fact, there is one sector of writing that I think is very much in danger of coming to this point, and that is the area of writing code. Because many young software engineers and other people in coding professions are using AI-generated coding for very basic problems. If all we can do is recognize the code that we want, it is plausible to wonder, will we ever lose our ability to code ourselves? I think that could very realistically happen. And the question is, if we forget how to code or to write, is it a bad thing? Is it bad for us to have only a passive knowledge of writing or coding? Yes, I think so. Now wait, you may say, hold on. The vast majority of humans in history did not learn to read and write. Were they unable to flourish as a result of that fact? Were they less in their humanity? Not at all. But the situation with illiterate people from the past is different than our situation today. I think it is true that there were many people who flourished in history who could not read or write. But those people had different intellectual capacities that made up for the lack of writing, namely exactly what Plato was lionizing, a powerful and better memory skill. In fact, illiterate people often have impressive and prodigious memories. However, they were able to develop these prodigious memories because they had a culture that knew how to foster such powers of the mind through the development of a powerful imagination and practice in memory. But in our culture, it is very difficult to develop such powerful memories, largely because the visual media has taken the place of personal imagination. So in a culture like ours, where television, movies, games, and yes, reading and writing are central modes of communication, our imaginations are not as powerful as people who lived even a century ago. And so we have a limitation that illiterate people of the past did not have. Namely, we do not have powerful imaginations that can aid us in the development of the memory capacity to make sure that we have information stored in our minds. We have come to depend upon computers, our phones, and books to store that information for us. And so, whereas illiterate people in the past could still have a lot of information, we who don't have this power for memory, if we don't read, what will we have? The second reason why loss of writing ability is bad is that when we come to depend on someone or something else to communicate for us, there is inevitably some compromise that happens. So, for example, think about the game of telephone. When we pass information indirectly through many people, often the original message gets radically distorted because each individual slightly changes or understands slightly differently the information that was originally passed along. Something like this happens with AI assistance as well, Anyone who has tried to get an AI image generator to give you precisely the image that you want every time knows the frustration that can be involved. Even the best images end up with 6 or 7 fingers and maybe with an extra leg or two. And then, and they will be a bit off, and you have to work with them and work with them until finally you're like, okay, good enough. But it's always just good enough, right? The danger here is one of communication. If you don't have full control over the words and expressions that are being used to present your message, the information is likely going to be conveyed in a way that is slightly different, or maybe greatly different, than you intend. This is a problem because often listeners may receive the wrong message or pick up the wrong point because of the subtlety that you were unable to identify as a passive writer. This, by the way, is why it is relatively easy for professors to figure out when students have used AI-assisted writing, because the information being sent back is often noticeably off in some way. Now for a third problem with AI-assisted writing. If we become dependent upon artificial intelligence for writing our communications, it is very possible that not only our ability to write, but our ability to read will atrophy. One thing that we know has already happened is that many people your age have find it difficult to read or for pleasure for an extended period of time. If we all begin to lose the ability to write, it becomes significantly harder to read and to focus for any length of time. The result of this is that our communication skills will also become severely limited. So to be able to write on our own without a dependence upon an AI model is an important skill, for it helps us to make sure that we communicate with others both in a clear way, but also in a human way. And to lose this skill is to lose a significant amount of freedom that we enjoy in communication. And to lose that freedom of communication is, in a way, to lose part of our humanity, because we're not developing that potential that we have. All right, with that in mind, I'm going to move on to a new point. There's, of course, more at stake here than just our ability to write and communicate. I don't know about you, but I find that writing helps me to learn. Not only that, it helps me to understand what I'm learning. It's common knowledge among teachers that if you want to know a subject better, the best way to do that is to teach a class on it. That may sound odd, but when you consider the process of teaching, it requires figuring out how to make complex topics more understandable to those who are just beginning to learn. Such preparation requires thinking through a topic in a new way, so as to make it available to other minds. You go from just having passive knowledge of a topic to active knowledge when you can explain it. And so there's really no better way to learn than to prepare to teach. Something similar is true again of computer coding. There is a common form of debugging called rubber duck debugging. The idea behind this is that if there's a problem with your code, but you are unsure where exactly it is, you set up a rubber duck and you try to explain every part of the code to the duck as if it were a person. This process has proven invaluable, because in trying to explain the code to another, even to an inanimate object like a rubber duck, we frequently discover where the mistakes lie, and because we are looking at the code with a different eye when we try to explain it to someone else. Something like this happens when we write. Why? Because when we write, we're writing to somebody who's not there, who can't pick up on context clues, who can't pick up on the nuances of gesture and facial features and tone of voice. How often do we write something in email and somebody misunderstands that? Because they can't get the tone of voice. And so to write and to write clearly requires that we think carefully about our expressions. This is why the best writers say that to write well means to write over and over and over again. Because what you're trying to do is to clearly articulate something so that anybody outside of context clues can understand the meaning of what you are trying to convey. And so in a way, when you write to explain things to other people, whether it's a complex topic like an academic thesis, or whether it's just your complex emotions or ideas, people who are able to write are able to come to a better understanding of their knowledge, and for those who journal, quite often, a better understanding of themselves. because writing is in a way is a way in which we learn to process. In fact, this is how writing developed over time to replace memory. For those who had to learn how to memorize large texts or large bits of information that oftentimes we would just write down, you had to create a very serious way of reflecting and repeating and imagining these types of things that you want. And you do that over and over again until you get the right source. Likewise, with writing, you do that, but you do it in a way in which you are extending your knowledge so that you're interacting with it on the page. And so to lose writing would be a great loss to us. With that then, what does this tell us about artificial assisted writing? May we use it? Ought we to use it? It tells us that there are a significant number of dangers, and that Plato reminds us that we should keep these dangers in mind. But nevertheless, it seems possible that we could use this technology to legitimately assist us rather than hinder us. After all, we now use the very technology that Plato criticized. In fact, I'm trying to defend the very technology that Plato criticized in writing. And so likewise, it does seem possible that we could use AI assistance in writing in a way that aids us in understanding but doesn't hinder us. The key, though, is to make sure that we use AI assistance as a tool and not as a crutch. If we rely on it as a crutch, we try to use the technology to replace our own abilities. But if we use it as an aid, then we use it to enhance our abilities. How can we know the difference? Well, you have to ask yourselves, when you use AI assistance to help you, do you understand that thing better afterwards or worse? Do you say, okay, I've got the information to move on? Or do you say, that's weird, I didn't understand it that way before. Can I think about it again? Right. The question is, does your use of AI assistance help you to engage with the material better or worse? I would say, considering the writing samples I've given, probably worse if you're using it for writing. And so my suggestion is to first learn how to write well before you use it to assist you in writing more quickly. Because if you write quickly, you will never really be able to understand what you're talking about. But if you can more deeply engage with it and then use this tool to help you to engage better, that will then assist you in growing in knowledge and wisdom and understanding. But what that looks like, I can't tell you at the moment, because this tool is still so very new. And most people who are using it as a crutch and not as an aid. We still need to develop that. But if you yourselves are still developing writing, stick to that rather than AI assistance. And when you are confident that you know how to write and to write well and to write beautifully, then see how AI assisted writing can help you to enhance that for the betterment of others and for yourself. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith. And it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.